My name is John Grebe. We bring you this program Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 1 o'clock Eastern Time, and our stream's linked from WZBC.org. We talked last week about the terrorist group, the MEK, the Mujahideen-e Khalq. Terrorist group, I say, because the United States State Department has classified them that way for years. We spoke last week with former RAND Corporation analyst Jeremiah Gulka, who described some of the even cult-like background of the MEK, headed and operated by a husband and wife team, people who have killed thousands of Iranians inside Iran. They were allied with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, to the great distaste, if not enmity, of Iranian citizens who witnessed those killings. I'm very glad that we have with us today the author of the brand new article in The New Yorker magazine, Seymour Hersh, who's written about our men in Iran, asking, could the Mujahideen-e Khalq be our men in Iran? Seymour Hersh's investigative reporter, whose new article in The New Yorker reports on the secret U.S. military training of the terrorist Mujahideen-e Khalq in Nevada, of all places. Seymour Hersh writes for The New Yorker on military and security affairs. He exposed the U.S. military's torture and abuses at Abu Ghraib in Iraq in 2004. He's a five-time George Polk Award winner, and his reporting broke the story of the 1968 massacre by the U.S. Army of 350 to 500 civilians, mostly children, women, and elderly people, all unarmed in My Lai, Vietnam, and the attempted cover-up by the Army and even congressmen. He received the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for that story. Sy Hersh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure.
A fascinating article. Tell us what you found out and when about this operation in 2005 by the United States military in Nevada.
Yeah, hi. First, John, it's actually online in The New Yorker. They have a very good webpage these days, and sometimes it's just as easy to write online for them as it is in the magazine. But anyway, it's the same process. It's checked just as carefully. Actually, I learned many years ago in the fall of 05, it was in the middle of all sorts of other stuff. I was told that we had actually begun training some members of the Khalq, or the MEK, as we call it in America, in Nevada at a former, it's called the Nevada National Security Site. It's where we used to do after World War II, we did a lot of nuclear testing in that area. It's very close to Nevada, deep in the south of Las Vegas. It's deep in the south of Nevada, and there's huge tracts of federally owned land that you basically can't get on. I mean, at the risk of death, that there's all sorts of signs warning that of the consequences if you jump a fence. And there's among the things that's happened at this, it's called, as I said, the Nevada National Security Test Site. In the last dozen or so years, it's become pretty much an operational facility. I would also guess for rendition flights at some point very early after 9/11, there's a big landing strip there that's off limits to everybody. It's got yellow, for many years it had yellow crosses, which meant not operable, but it was operable. Many planes landed there after 9/11. And it also was a training facility for foreign nationals where we could train with the Israelis, for example, some of their more classified units or commando units. We did training there. And also there's a lot of facilities in America where you can bring foreigners in without clearing them through customs, et cetera. And they land at this remote base, and we have training facilities. We started bringing the MEK there sometime early in 05. For extensive training. I'll tell you as much as I know, which is simply that it was obviously very classified, and it was all part of the, at that time, Vice President Cheney and George Bush had this obsession that Iran had a secret facility somewhere, which doesn't exist. It's pretty clear now, but at that time they really thought that Iran was deeply involved in making bombs, and they were really anxious about Iran. And so they brought in the Khalq, the MEK, for advanced training in, you don't have to train those guys how to kill, and you don't actually have to tell them who to kill or what to do, because they're as you said in your preamble, they're killers. At least they have elements who kill, and Iranians, they're very hostile to the regime, and it goes both ways, of course. And so we began training them most significantly in communications and cryptography, how to handle our how to intercept communications, how to translate them, how to work with us, presumably uplinking and downlinking to our satellites or drones, which would get them more flexible. We also train them in small unit tactics and in the usual stuff sometimes we might gather. I infer from what I've told in some interrogation tactics that we know about. And the thing that's interesting about the Nevada test site, if you took a look at it from a satellite photograph just on Google Earth and compared it with Northwest around, it's the same sort of landscape. It's arid, very little, 15 inches or more rain a year, arid plains and mountainous. And so it's a replica of where they would operate, perhaps, inside the border of Iran, the cult coming in from Kurdistan.
And also, coming in from the Iraqi border, even. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I think they would come in from there. We also, it's a very democratic process we have in operations against Iran. We also use Azeris, who are opposition people inside Iran, longtime opposition to the leadership. We also use Iranian Kurds, who are dissenters. We also use even Jandela, the Sunni sort of wacko terrorist that would come in from sometimes from Balochistan in India and also come in from Afghanistan, from Herat. We had a lot of what we call rat lines to get inside. There was a lot of penetration by this very highly classified American unit known as the Joint Special Operations Command. They would go in and out, beginning, I'd say, even in late 04, for many years. They would go in and out. I don't think the best I could make about the training for the MEK was that groups were flown in. I don't know how many groups. It probably ended by late 87, early 08. It certainly ended, I think, before Obama got in. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the idea of American support for the cult ended. It's still very much ongoing. We work with the Israelis in supplying intelligence. And presumably, there are some bases in Kurdistan that have been used forever as sort of retreat and resupply bases for the MEK to go in and out cross-border. And so clearly the American involvement is still not as intense as it was, but still there.
You mentioned the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC. This was a military structure that we heard about during the Iraq War and in Afghanistan. They conduct operations among the different branches of the military. And is it served directly under the direction of the National Security Council?
JSOC. I don't know what the relationship precisely is now. I can tell you in the heyday of Dick Cheney and George Bush, it basically was an executive agency, worked directly for the White House. I'd say even today there's tremendous tension between the Joint Special Operations Command and even the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the NSC. They certainly work for the highest levels of the government. I mean, we're talking about in the White House. The Joint Special Operations Command is a separate unit. It promotes them within. In other words, it's a member on paper. It belongs to the Special Operations Command, SOCOM, which is based in Tampa, but actually it's a self-contained unit. At one point, one of the leaders, McChrystal, General McChrystal, Stanley McChrystal, who came to ground about a year or so ago after a Rolling Stone dispatch, if you remember that story, he was running the war in Afghanistan and shot his mouth off to a reporter, and was replaced. He was head of the command for 5 years. And the man running it now, Admiral McRaven, has been head of that command since 07. It's almost a continuum.
McChrystal spoke too frankly and with too many swear words, I suppose, in the presence of a reporter. Was that
the problem? It was also he made fun of Biden and he made fun of Holbrooke. He was critical and he basically was condescending, I would say easily, certainly to the president and to the idea of national command authority. They're an interesting group because right now they really want to be, if they had a dream, it would be to be a separate power. I mean, they find it very humiliating, the Joint Special Operations Commands, to sometimes have to ask the Air Force for airlift or the Navy for a secret submarine movement. So they're really interested in being a self-contained unit. They're not yet, but there's a lot of tension in the American military about the JSOC and the Special Operations Commands. The Special Operations in general, they seem to be running the Army in the ground. The regular Army is now sort of a lesser force. JSOC's the boys, the Navy SEALs, et cetera, yes.
You mentioned that after the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq in 2003, JSOC started operating inside Iran and...
Well, 04, late 04 probably.
Uh-huh. And the MEK, of course, had been working with Saddam Hussein. I don't know if it was right up until that point of Saddam's overthrow, coup against, well, by the United States government overthrow. But the MEK began developing ties with, you say, Western intelligence after that, was it?
Yeah, there's no question. After the fall of Saddam, we were interested in the MEK because of its activities inside Iran. And has knowledge about Iran. And don't forget, they spoke, they were Farsi speakers, and we were desperately short of Farsi speakers.
The language in Iran.
Yes, absolutely. There's no question that some of the MEK were recruited and put to work for us in various military units, I think even at sea, translations, doing translation. For some reason, the services, even though there's many Farsi speakers natively in America, the same with Pashtun speakers after the 9/11, the American community is always reluctant to get Americans who are living, have lived there and have now become citizens. That they seem to be reluctant. They seem to be worried about double agents or something. So there's a lot of tension about who's going to translate for us. And we certainly use the MEK. We saw them as dependable in terms of being in opposition to Iran. And they were used. I think by 04, late 04, we were inside Iran. I don't think there's any question that the Brits were deeply involved in anti-Iranian activity, and also the Israelis, of course. I just don't, it's hard to say when. This is also secret. I know I was told in 04, late 04, that we were in by then. We were there inside the country recruiting opposition people to run. You know, we weren't doing much ourselves. We were using surrogates, and I think that principle still exists. In other words, the MEK today is still a surrogate of the American intelligence service as it is of the Israelis. I don't know how much the British role continues, but it certainly was there until a few years ago.
Sihirs, you mentioned that the MEK in 2002, you say, before Saddam Hussein was overthrown, publicly revealed that Iran had started enriching uranium in a secret underground location, and who told you the source of that information the MEK got?
Well, what they actually said was they actually said that they had a nuclear facility, which was assumed to be for enrichment. There's no other reason they would do it. They actually said they revealed a nuclear facility. The notion of enriching a centrifuge came later, but that was the assumption from the very beginning. Well, I heard about it from inside the American community, but I did in the conversation with Mohammed El-Baradei, who was then the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, which is the UN's monitoring, you know, they monitor the National Nonproliferation Treaty. And Iran, by the way, has signed the treaty. And there's absolutely no evidence, despite all you hear, there's been no evidence in all of the reports of the IAEA. They do four reports a year they have been doing on Iranian activities. Every bit of nuclear activity and reactor and enrichment activity inside Iran is under IAEA camera inspection. And the IAEA has reported repeatedly, consistently, for 10 years that there's been no, less than that, 8 years, there's been no known diversion of any material. In other words, any materials they enrich, they're enriching uranium primarily to about 3.6% to run in a power plant for producing electricity like we do here, or like alas in Japan they did. Not even 4%. They also have a small pilot production where they enrich more to 20% for medical purposes, but that's under camera too.
And just to be ultra clear for people who are new to this whole structure, is that Iran's right, as it is the right of all other signatories to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, to enrich?
And not only that, there's just no evidence of a diversion. And as I've written many times in the New Yorker, and this was something, it was, you know, talk about Johnny One Note, I must have written five or six stories in the last six or seven long pieces. The piece in the New Yorker webpage is just, 1,500 or a couple thousand words shorter, which is a fun access for me. But the long, long reporting pieces, pieces I worked months on before publishing, I've been saying repeatedly that there's just no evidence of a secret program, you know, despite the fact that Dick Cheney and Bush, you know, I don't know whether they ever saw the Woody Allen movie Bananas, but they had this vision of little robots working underground building things, and we haven't been able to find it. So essentially, the American position right now is, to be honest, is that we are now sanctioning Iran to force them to stop building a weapons program that we have all the intelligence in the world that says they're not. So it's, once again, it's screwball politics. But to get back to your point about what the MEK announced, when they announced that there was this facility, a place called Natanz, an underground facility for nuclear activity, I was talking to El Baradi, I think, later that year in 02, and maybe perhaps early in 03, and El Baradi mentioned that he had separate intelligence on that. And El Baradi, as you know, won the Nobel Peace Prize for his activities on behalf of monitoring and stopping. Initially, everybody was enraged at the Iranians for cheating, which they did. They built a facility without declaring it to the IAEA. Their explanation, which eventually was accepted by the IAEA, El Baradi in particular, in a public document, 5 or 6 years later, they finally looked at all the papers. And Iran's position was, in the middle 80s, given the hostility America had towards Iran, and as you know, we supported Saddam during the horrible eight-year war that took place between Iran and Iraq between 1980 and 1988. We were on Saddam's side in all that time. Iran knew if they ever decided to go and build a commercial reactor, they have a lot of power shortages in Tehran, the main capital. In the summer, they go on and off for 4 hours a day. They have a lot of problem with sustaining enough power, electrical energy. So they knew if they wanted to build a nuclear power plant, we would stop it if they announced it. So they snuck. They cheated. And there's no question they did. They built it in camera. And they got caught. And it was a bad moment. And at that point, a lot of people were convinced, people I respected a great deal, that Iran really did have secret plans. They brought a lot of problems onto themselves.
Did you mean at that point? At that point, are you talking about having built a nuclear power plant or a nuclear fuel enrichment station?
Beginning to enrich fuel. They were beginning to put centrifuge into places in the tons and beginning to run what we call cascading in order to produce even at 3 or 4% natural uranium. You have to, you know, there's very little, you know, the kind of uranium you need to toggle a bomb. It has to be 99% pure enriched uranium, but to enrich even a 3 or 4%, you need to run a centrifuge. You need to run them in tandem. It's called in cascades to get to separate the highly radioactive elements from the normal, the normal elements. In any case, a naturally occurring uranium is very low. It doesn't have much enrichment. It's not particularly dangerous. And anyway, it's all over the world.
Cy Hirsch, I'm curious to move back to where we left off in your recent article in The New Yorker. And for listeners who are just joining us, you can find this at newyorker.com. Seymour Hirsch's new piece entitled Our Men in Iran? And there seems to be no question mark about it, that at least some American-supported covert operations continue, as you write, in Iran today, according to past and present intelligence officials and military consultants you've spoken to. This is something that sheds light. If Iran is aware of U.S. covert operations within its borders, it sheds light on Iran's what some perceived in the United States as paranoia for example, holding a couple of the young reporters out on a hiking trip who apparently stumbled across the Iranian border several years ago, much to the consternation of lots of the reporting community and other people in the United States who wondered why Iran would hold these young people who seem to have no affiliation to U.S. intelligence at all.
Well, of course. I can't say that I can't say who's good and who's bad. I could just tell you that the notion that the Iranians don't know pretty much what we're doing is comical. They have terrific intelligence. They have a very good intelligence service, and it's clear. I mean, there's been a series of assassinations. I think 5 or 6 anyway. In recent years, just earlier this year, another Iranian scientist was killed, and the Israelis sort of Vachik took credit for it without explicitly doing it. It's not clear whether, as I say, you really don't have to tell the MEK to kill people. You might have to give them information about who's the right person to kill, and there might be, you know, I've actually heard, I didn't report this, but I've heard this, that the hit lists have been drawn up in Israel and also in America very early in the Cheney years. There were lists of scientists we'd like to see gone. inside their system, and certainly try to recruit them and capture them and kill them, et cetera. That's going on all the time.
Although it's been said that recently some of the Iranian scientists who were killed were not the quote-unquote Einsteins of the operation. Go ahead.
Well, then the point being that the general purpose, I quoted somebody in the blog piece today in the New Yorker, yesterday in the New Yorker, I quoted a senior, somebody who knows, saying, look, the purpose is to demoralize and do these sort of hit-and-run tactics, to hit a pipeline here, hit an oil field there, hit a electrical facility, hit a mosque even sometimes, kill somebody. The whole purpose is destabilization. I don't think it's necessarily regime change, because that seems to be impossible. We've given up that ghost. It's not going to happen. But they're caused internal chaos and dissension, and unnerve the Iranian population and create distress. I mean, it does create tension when some scientists, this young man who was killed in early this year in January, you know, a car in the middle of Tehran, somebody slaps an explosive mine, a limpet mine, actually a very sophisticated kind of mine that our Navy SEALs use. It's a kind of mine that, it's a bomb that explodes inwards. The kind you would use if you wanted to attack a ship underwater. You wouldn't want a bomb that exploded outward. That wouldn't do it. You'd have to explode inward. And also, it would eliminate collateral deaths. You'd just be destroying people in that one car and not around the area. Very sophisticated devices that I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know, but it seems pretty clear that there was some help with in how to use and manufacture and plant those and place those kind of limpet mines, or Navy limpet mines.
Now, I'm curious to ask. I'm curious to ask you, Sy Hirsch, about, you mentioned that the JSOC, this Special Operations Command, started operating inside Iran. This is U.S. forces operating inside Iran covertly to try to substantiate Bush administration fears Iran was building the bomb, which, of course, it has not been able to substantiate at some secret underground location. You mentioned that training that JSOC started under Bush and Cheney and ended before President Obama took office, at least according to what you've been able to find out. But these operations inside Iran, are they? There's evidence they're still going on?
Well, what it was is the training of MEK in America, in Nevada, lasted apparently a couple of years, maybe a slightly longer on both ends. Began in early 05, maybe late 04, ended in 07, could have toggled over. We sent units in to be trained. And what we did is we made the MBK more efficient, more effective. We taught them not how to kill, you don't have to do that, but how to use small unit tactics, how to communicate more efficiently, how to use encryption, how to decode and encode material so that the Iranians are very good, the Iranian government is very good at counter-espionage, counterintelligence. And also just monitoring signals and breaking codes. So we trained them on how to communicate with each other without the Iranians listening in. That was going on here for 2-3 years. That did end, by all accounts, that kind of training, like sort of high-risk stuff. You're bringing people on a terrorist list to be trained inside America. I mean, that's right in your face, fella.
And
that's a lot of us to do that. That ended by 07, 08. That we use surrogates today inside Iran, that the MEK, that the dissident Azeris, dissident Kurds aren't supported by us with intelligence, and I would guess with money, either directly or passed through the Israelis or passed through the Brits, I would guess that's still going on. There's no reason not to be doing that kind of stuff, covert stuff. We do it all the time, and that's still going on. But the overt sort of in-your-face tactic of training them in America, I don't think goes on anymore, at least so I've been told.
And this is this communications training. It also could enable a covert force, long-range patrol sort of situation inside Iran, for example, to be in touch with electronic communications with some kind of United States command outside the borders of Iran.
Well, certainly with a satellite, I mean, of course, I don't know that, but I mean, I would be stunned if that wasn't so. You're not training them in communications and cryptography, which we were, because you don't want to be able to communicate with them in some way. And that seems to be that kind of passive communication with a surrogate is essential. I wasn't explicitly told that, but that's, you know, that's a perfectly rational inference to make, that you're not training them in communication because you don't want to talk to them anymore. And you're not training them because you're worried about them talking to each other. That's not such the issue. It's talking to outsiders.
You told me this Masoud Kodabanda.
Yes, who's been, by the way, if you went to the New Yorker website today, there's about, oh, I don't know, more than 44, 45 comments as of this morning. So many so hostile to him, the MEK, and to me. He's considered, the MEK are really pretty venomous. There's a lot of very nasty things being said, accusing, a long letter to the New Yorker, basically accusing me and the New Yorker of being pro-agents of Iran. And Kodabana is categorically described as a classic agent. He acknowledged, and I must say, the editors added a line to the piece, which I thought was great, because I thought it was implicit. They said, let's make it explicit. He acknowledges he's an enemy of the MEK. He was a defector, and he's very hostile to them, and he's worked against them for years, Kodabande. But that doesn't make him pro-Iranian or an Iranian agent. But that's the way it's seen. It's an amazing business, particularly, as you know, the MEK is spending God knows where they get the money, whether it's independently or how it's financed. They've been working with a lot of former very prominent Americans, Rudy Giuliani, the former Attorney General for Bush, Mukasey, Ed Rendell, the Democratic former governor of Pennsylvania, Howard Dean, the national chairman, all have been publicly espousing the MEK. And there's been a lot of allegations and even some investigations by the Treasury Department that some of these officials, American officials, who endorse and support the position of the MEK and insist that it should be taken off the terrorist list, have actually been given funds, been paid essentially enormous fees to give speeches, you know, $20,000, $30,000, etc. for short speeches to MEK groups, which looks, you know, has the appearance of violating some of the laws we have for in America. There are laws that you cannot actively support a terrorist group. And so that's a very complicated issue. But
yeah, people's entire bank accounts have been frozen for doing less than that. And not to bang the point home too deeply, but we're talking about major American former officials here, from ranging from Howard Dean, Democratic Party former official, to John Bolton on the other end of the political spectrum, in addition to the people that you mentioned, as well as former FBI and CIA.
Some very high-ranking former military generals and admirals too. So it's a huge collection of prominent American politicians, military people, intelligence people who are actively demanding that the government take the MEK off the terrorist list. And in some cases, there's concern by the Treasury Department and other agencies. I presume, I wouldn't be surprised if Justice Department is looking at it.
Treasury has begun investigating it.
Yes, and whether or not there's a quid pro quo, and whether or not this would be a violation of the anti-terrorism law, which is a terrible law anyway, because I'm one of those people who think words are what America's all about, but that's another issue. The fact is, the law's there, and it's the government seems to be in its own way proceeding. This whole thing is potentially embarrassing for this administration, and certainly raises more questions about how much we didn't know in the old administration. But I've been doing a book about Cheney for the last couple of years, Cheney and Bush, and I can tell you, it's pretty amazing what we didn't know. It's breathtaking. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Well, we look forward to that.
Yes, and so if you have anything else, holler away.
It's close to
springtime.
Close to time to wrap up. I'll just ask you. You mentioned, I believe, at the end of the article, saying that mid-January this year, a few days after this assassination by car bomb of the Iranian nuclear scientist there, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta acknowledged the U.S. said he has some ideas as to who might be involved, but we don't know exactly who was involved.
I think that article, that statement, I don't think you have to say more than after you write a long article about American support for the MEK and use of them as surrogates. And here's Leon. There is this sort of, he does have a I always liked Leon. He's a very, I've known him, you know, obviously I don't know him well, but he, as you know, he's been a Washington congressman. And he worked for the Clinton administration. Very straightforward guy. I don't know whether, I think that was a response to a question. And he just, you know, he did say, well, we have some idea. You bet he has some idea. But I also think it's also true that my heuristic thought is that when someone gets killed inside Iran, we don't actually know about it till after the fact. You know, we're not, we may be, you know, the technical term for what we're doing by supplying intelligence and other support, maybe aiding and abetting, but not specifically. So, you know, he certainly knows more than he said in that speech, in that little talk, that comment, but he said, it was quite a mouthful, he said. Good old Leon.
Well, Seymour Hersh, thank you tremendously for joining us today. I'll let listeners know at newyorker.com. They can find your article asking our men in Iran about the Kalk, the Mujahideen Kalk, the MEK. Thank you so much, Seymour Hersh.
Glad to talk to you, John.
Our pleasure.